No, I didn't ask this at the outset, but I'm assuming that most of you are from the greater Santa Barbara metropolis, but anybody from Ventura, Ojai?
Camarillo.
Okay, good. Well, we're named. All right. So, you know, hang on to this power analysis thing, and a couple people have mentioned it'd be good for those of you who are in just faith groups. I agree that'd be an ideal setting to do some of this work. And if you do use this, you know, feel free to drop us an email and give us your feedback, because we're always trying to improve. It's just sort of a working model, and we're always interested in what your experience is with it. What I want to do in part three is following Michael's lead. Is I want to talk about the E word, and one of the reasons I felt I could do this is last time I was here, we talked about nonviolence pretty much the whole time, and I think that's important. But because Michael really moved from nonviolence to economic justice as the great central North American expression of, quote, meekness, what I want to do is I want to zero in two different ways. I want to zero in on the sphere of economics as a sphere to practice nonviolence. Not to suggest it's the only sphere, but very much to suggest that it is the most important sphere for relatively affluent North Americans. We're a country at war. And probably most of you in this room would not support the war, but the tax dollars do. We are all probably people who have a lot of sympathy with poor folk, but we might not see poor folk very often as a result of a particular social architecture that we all live in. So I want to zero in on economics, and then I want to zero in even further. And I want to talk about your bank. Now, I do this knowing that for some of you it'll be too specific and therefore uncomfortable, and that's okay from my point of view, because I think that is the job of an animator, is to move from theory to practice. And when I suggest very specific things, they're meant to be suggestions, not imperious commandments. You can take it for what it's worth, but I hope you'll take it seriously. Because if nonviolence is really all about power as it's configured in wealth, then how we handle our assets is sort of where the rubber meets the road. And if all of that sounds like bad news, I want to assure you that the good news is there are very specific steps, discipleship steps, we can and should take to deal with our relative affluence. I say that knowing that there are some folks in the group who are probably, have a net worth of multi-millions of dollars, and other people in the group who don't. That's okay, because relative to the globe, and indeed probably relative to the poorest folks in Santa Barbara County, we are all relatively affluent. And I want to talk about that, because somebody's got to. Some of you know this little Sabbath economics booklet. It's circulated around, and a number of you have had a chance to take a look at it. The fundamental biblical principle of justice is an economic one, and we need it early on in the biblical tradition. So I want to just read from Exodus 16. Here's the famous story of the manna in the wilderness.
This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, every one of you, as much as you can eat. You shall take an omer apiece, according to the number of the persons to which you had in your tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, the ones who gathered much had nothing over, and the ones that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what they could eat.
This is what you might call a primal, archetypal, biblical narrative. the kind of story you learn in Sunday school. Everybody knows the story of the man in the wilderness. But we, it's been highly sentimentalized, and we don't see that what this is an old wisdom tale that tells us everything we need to know about economic value. And that is, A, everything that is truly of value is a gift from God, the manna. It is a gift. B, it is a gift that the community, therefore, has the obligation to ensure that it's distributed equitably. And C, what that concretely means is that there are some, if there are some who have more, they don't have too much. And if there are some who have less, they have enough. That is the fundamental biblical principle of economics. It is also the mirror opposite of our economy. You cannot be too rich, and you cannot be too poor in our economy. So we haven't done too well on the gathering and distribution of the gift. Try to look at this sort of as a biblical concept at length in the pamphlet, and if some of you are interested, there are some flyers over there. It's just entering its fourth reprinting, which is why I didn't have. We ran out, so we're going to get more next week. reality check, right? Bush just came out with his 2007 budget, and he wants to cut $183 billion from domestic programs during the next 5 years. Now, friends, that is, it can't get any more concrete than that. That will trickle down to Santa Barbara County, and it will translate as more homeless folks, more folks who are living in what is called the working poor sector, who are actually losing ground. It will translate into a housing crisis. It will translate into more problems for our schools. This is the real terrain of justice and hence nonviolence. And we are, as you well know, in the midst of an administration that believes in rewarding the rich with tax cuts and essentially punishing the poor through cuts in public programs. It's important that we all remember, particularly a group like this who probably isn't reliant on public benefits very much, that public benefits actually reduce poverty. That is what the Republicans don't want you to know. They think that, you know, government handouts destroy people's self-esteem. The fact is, over time, the difference that a little bit of public assistance, whether that's food stamps or a Head Start program or whatever, makes in low-income people's lives is enormous. Meanwhile, of course, we're spending billions of dollars that isn't being calculated, honestly, in the budgets that go to Congress or are made by Congress. You know, this stuff is going into war, which it has a price tag it can't possibly be too high yet.
I think that it does a disservice to basically the Constitution to be blaming it on one person, which Congress is the one, only two people that can do this. So to always be blaming it on one person, not saying Feinstein and Boxer voted for every single dime on this. Yeah. They just all, so to say this, it's amazing that people forget that the president can't pass one bill, or, you know, can't get any money and can't go and do this without the
consent of Congress. It's a systemic problem. It's an administration problem.
It is a congressional. It is Congress that is doing this.
Yes, it is.
And they slide by. They say, oh, isn't that horrible? All that president is doing horrible things. And no one, not one person, ever said, Mrs. Clinton and Boxer and Feinstein
well,
for all that. No one ever said it. It's all about the president, you know.
Well, I appreciate your breaking through the veil of culpability that surrounds certain California senators.
There are
a couple of things that we haven't figured out as a society. One is we haven't solved the problem of affluence. And I mean that very sincerely. We live in a society where there is a lot of too much in it, called by some affluent. And there's sort of an epidemic of the pathologies that are surround too much. One is anxiety. And Michael talks a lot about this in his book. People who are well off have a lot of anxiety because they're trying to protect their perceived privilege. He talks a lot about that in this chapter. Just driving over here today, I heard on the radio there's been a new global poll about happiness in societies all around the world. Did you hear that?
Right.
The happiest society in the world, according to these researchers, is Nigeria. And the other four are all Latin American. U.S. ranks 16th in the poll on happiness. Think that has anything to do with affluenza? A great deal of anxiety that we have about getting and keeping, a great deal of alienation that comes from people who really think that their self-esteem is tied to their car. And, of course, there's epidemic addiction. And I don't mean just substance abuse, although there's plenty of that. But there's a great deal of public addiction in our relationship with our privilege, with our status, and with our stuff. So we really haven't solved the problem of affluence. By the same token, we haven't solved the problem of difference or wealth disparity in the U.S. and abroad. And that's really what we're trying to get at in our discipleship of nonviolence as it relates to wealth, is how do we begin to engage these issues, especially when they seem so big. And I love what you're saying about it's so easy to exonerate ourselves and blame it on somebody else. The more remote, the better. Disparity is not just a static thing. It is a growing thing. The economy between 1947 and 49 grew with relative equity, but really in the last 30 years what you find is radical disparity, in which the top 5% of the economy has grown 81% and the bottom 20% has grown 3%. We are a society that is increasingly polarized in terms of wealth. And I think you all know many of the statistics. This statistic in particular, I think, is very telling. That in the last quarter of a century, the bottom 40% of it all actually lost almost three quarters of the net worth, while the top 1% has grown almost by half. And you all know the stories of the way that wealth is distributed in our society. I'm not one who believes that statistics or pie charts have the power to change hearts and minds. They're just snapshots. But we better know the objective conditions of the dominant society if we're going to figure out how we are going to move in the midst of it. And supporting all of this, including in our churches, is a culture which tends to aspire upwards, right? We all want to advance ourselves and scapegoat downwards. And that affects not only our social perceptions, but our very most intimate personal aspirations. And despite the fact that Jesus does exactly the opposite, he extends solidarity to the least, and he's highly critical of those who are the most powerful. So there's a real disconnect between Jesus and the culture that prevails in most of our churches, particularly around questions of power and wealth. It's dawning on certain even mainstream economists that this is really reaching a crisis point, and this book by William Grider says it, I think, dramatically. We need a new narrative of American capitalism. If we're going to discover a new economic narrative, I think our scriptures, old and wise, can help us do that. But our church is going to have to start talking about the E word. You know, it's harder to talk about economics in church than it is sex. It really is, isn't it? So it's important that we break the taboo, not only on these theological issues we were talking about last hour, but around these very concrete issues. So that's sort of, generally speaking, the orientation around economic justice. The prophets, the biblical tradition is very explicit. You know, Isaiah looks out of the scripture right at us and says, I wonder if you have anything that belongs to the poor in your closet. And what is my answer to that? You know, this is where discipleship really begins to take on real meaning. Or that same Isaiah looks out and pronounces fairly severe judgment. Woe to you who join house to house, field to field, until there is room for no one but you.
You know, sometimes when I'm driving through Montecito, I have a friend who manages a farm there. And I look around and I think, these people really live as if there's nobody in the world but them. And it's just we have to continually remind ourselves of how whatever our subjective socialized perception is, the Bible's very clear, uncomfortably clear on these issues. Well, having said that, I want to come now to an even tighter focus. I want to ask whether we as faith communities can exercise enough moral imagination to offer alternatives to the kinds of values that are in the dominant culture. And I believe the single most important battleground, friends, for this is how I handle my money. That is the place where all of these issues intersect with the reality that's closest to me, namely my own economic life. The fact is, friends, that every one of us in this room has some surplus. That's true whether it's $100 stuffed under your mattress. Don't have to raise your hand, I know you're there. Or $1,000 tucked here and there in a little CD or a little money market. Or a whole portfolio that's managed by Merrill Lynch. We all have surplus. We all, well, let me just take a poll. Anybody not have a bank account? There are people who don't have bank accounts in Santa Barbara, but they're not in this room. We all have bank accounts. So the question is, who do you bank with? You see, until unless we're ready to really more radically redistribute our surplus, we need to figure out how we can be truly responsible in how we handle our surplus. Now, usually we assume that responsible stewardship means that we invest our personal or institutional surplus, this is as true of a parish as it is of a household, and we invest it in the market to get the highest rate of return, sounds familiar? Right? And we tend to justify this by claiming that if we get a high return, we can give more away, or we can send more to mission. Right? Hello, is this thing on? I'm talking about the life you live. All right? This is economic orthodoxy in our culture and in our church. Well, here's the problem. Oh, well, let's not go there. No, let's not go there. Let's just remind ourselves that the Bible is very clear about surplus. That surplus belongs to a realm of the principalities and powers. It works on us. When Jesus says you can't serve both God and mammon, he doesn't say you shouldn't. He says you can't. So the Bible tends to be fairly clear and unequivocal. So what that leaves for those of us in faith communities is what I like to call the three Zacchaeus questions, right? In Luke's gospel, Zacchaeus is sort of the archetypal disciple who confronts the reality of his privilege as it embodied in wealth. And I think three Zacchaeus questions for us today is, how much surplus capital do I have? What I mean by surplus capital is, it the money that you're not using to sustain your normal lifestyle, to stuff that's tucked away in short-term or long-term accounts. And if I'm not able to learn to divest or redistribute this wealth, as many of us aren't, how can I at least make my surplus available to those who are structurally poor simply because they don't have access to capital? Friends, what makes somebody poor in the United States is not that they're not handling money. Poor people handle money just like you do. The difference is it flows through their lives because they don't have equity, and they don't have equity because they don't have access to capital. They can't own a house because they can't get a loan. So when you drive by these check cashing places, and yeah, you even have them in Santa Barbara, or these payday loan places, or these places that rent furniture, that's the strain of the economy that's catering to the low-income folks who don't have equity. They're working harder than you and I are, and they're getting paid far less, and they can't hang on to money because they're not getting paid enough, and they can't get a loan. Oftentimes they can't even get a bank account, all right? It's sometimes called redlining. Banks redline all the time. They can't get credit. So if all of that is true, then wouldn't it be sort of a manna moment if those who had surplus capital could make the surplus capital available to those who don't? It's not giving it away, it's making it available. And you could see it as sort of a social mortgage on your surplus. What would that look like? So my question is it possible for us to work with our surplus with gospel values? And I think the good news is that it is possible. If, and I want you to pay attention to this, so I'm going to have somebody else read this. If what? Let me read that.
If we consider not only and not primarily the financial return on investment capital, but whether what the capital itself is doing conforms with the demands of social justice.
You with me so far? You understand that concept? Okay, now let me go back to economic orthodoxy. Most of us pursue what I call the black box method of investing or banking. Okay? But there's both. Some of your money sits there in a bank, and other of your money is sort of, quote, working for you in an investment, right? And a black box method of investing is you take your little loony, your little gold doubloon, right? And you take it down to Santa Barbara Bank and Trust, right? And you give it to them. And they do something with it. And you look at your statement, and you go, hallelujah, I just made 5% or 8%, right? And and if you are 2%, and if you were to ask yourself, or somebody were to ask you, how did you make that money? You'd say, I have no idea how I made that money. I just put it in a bank and somebody did something with it. But the question is, who did what to whom with it? That, friends, is the discipleship question. Right? So rather than taking the kind of classic hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, or in modern parlance, don't ask, don't tell, we can actually interrogate and investigate what and where our surplus capital goes. In order to move beyond the black box theory of investing, we have to acknowledge, and I don't think this is a big stretch, friends, that any capital that I own, whether it's a buck or a million, any capital deposited in any financial institution, a bank, a brokerage, is a measure of power. And the institution getting our investment is being given the right to decide who will have access to that power. So the question is, who are you partnering with your dollar? That's the bottom line, friends. It's very uncomfortably specific. And it's a question that is relevant for all of us. And if you don't know, then I want to suggest to you it's time to find out. If you don't care, then I want to ask you to reconsider in the light of the third beatitude, particularly the spin that Michael Crosby is giving on. I believe that a church that cares about the redistribution of social power through the practice of nonviolence in our specific context ought to have a mission to move our surplus capital from Wall Street bankers and corporate interests to low-income community development efforts. It's a no-brainer. It makes all the sense in the world. Make the money available to folks who are poor because it's the best strategy to pull folks out of poverty. So now you're asking yourself, that's a good idea, but what about, and you're thinking of the board of deacons at the parish, right? But we're going to make the highest return so we can give money to mission. That logic, of course, assumes that capital is put into a black box, we make a return, and then we send it to mission, which gives all the power to capital and gives the trickle down to mission, right? But what if we saw the paradigm differently? What if we saw how we invest our capital as the mission? The money is the mission, as well as for the mission. You follow? How might we do that? Here's the good news. I'm going to give you three stats, and I want you to take serious notes, if you would. Or at least ponder this. For some of you, this will be old news. For others of you, this will be new and good news. Here's the first step. Here's what I would call the minimum discipleship step. If you're going to hold shares or investments in mainstream corporations, banks, portfolios, the least we can do is ensure that our investments are being screened. So our money is not capitalizing business practices that we do not approve of. Right? Sweatshops are bad. Corporate pollution is bad. The arms industry is bad. I think most of us would share that moral universe. So why are we capitalizing these things in our portfolio? Well, mostly because we don't know, we don't care. We give it to the brokerage, they take it and run with it. All we care about is the return. I'm saying our discipleship invites us to get more involved. Now, some of you in this room have some socially screened investments, and there are a number of ways to look at socially screened message investments. One is analyzing and managing your own portfolio, at least to the extent where you know where your money is and whether it's going for sustainable practices and policies or not. And then there's two forms of screening. One is exclusionary screening, when you say, okay, I'm not going to fund big tobacco, I'm not going to fund, you know, big oil or whatever. And then the other is inclusionary screening, which is, I want to fund fair trade coffee. I love the idea of fair trade coffee. I even drink it at my parish. Did you know there are investment opportunities where you can actually capitalize small fair trade coffee companies? But your broker at Merrill Lynch is not going to tell you about it, because he's going to tell you that you're going to make less money. And what he really means is he's going to make less money. All right? So the good news...
Fair trade. Can you define fair trade?
Fair trade coffee is one of the big success stories in the last 15 years. Started out with a Folgers coffee boycott in New England, and a small little effort that grew into a globalizing from below strategy in which... I'm going to big corporate coffee brokers who are supporting exploitative plantations in the third world. There's a direct relationship between sustainably grown coffee, oftentimes organic, healthier, in which the growers are getting a larger percent of the actual return. It's an alternative distribution network. And how many of you drink fair trade coffee in your house or your church? Good, well, I don't want to ask how many of you drink coffee. Fair trade coffee, it's a no-brainer.
There's
fair trade tea too that's coming on.
Trader Joe's, they have fair trade.
Yeah, Trader Joe's starting to get to it. Even Starbucks was forced to have a fair trade line. The FRI industry in the United States is another one of those social responsibility success stories. It started out 30 years ago as sort of a mom-and-pop operation. It's now grown into a huge industry. One out of every 8 investment dollars in the United States are in SRI screen funds. That's good news. How many of you have some dollars in a social screen fund? Social responsible investment, SRI. How many of you have some dollars in a screen fund? Okay, we got some work to do. Friends, the reason I'm telling you this is to try to persuade you that it is easier than ever for you to move your investments into screen funds. Even mainstream brokers now have a socially responsible option. They won't tell you about it normally, but if you ask, and better, if you demand, and you say, look, if you want my business, you're going to have to start giving me some socially screened funds, then that's one of the ways that we, who consumers and change the industry. And if they won't, fire! And find somebody who will, because there are lots and lots of folks out there who will. So that's very good news, and if you need help finding social responsible brokers, financial advisors, we can hook you up with a network that will help you find them. Here's step two. Again, if, and I know this doesn't refer to everybody in this room, and sure enough doesn't refer to me. But if you have holdings in corporate interest, get involved. Shareholder activism and advocacy is one of the other aspects of responsibly dealing with our money. Don't just put it in a black box. Find out what's happening in the black box. The reason South Africa is free today, the reason apartheid was overturned, was because of experiments in the 1970s, largely led by churches, to take denominational holdings out of companies doing business in South Africa. The Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility was founded at that time and is still doing wonderful shareholder activism. One of the big issues today is predatory lending. How many of you got 3 credit card offers this week? We are all targets of predatory lending. It is the way the industry is going. It is hammering the poor in our country. And one of the places, if you're banking at Wells Fargo, you better know that Wells Fargo, through subsidiaries, is involved in predatory lending. If you're at B of A, you better know that B of A is indirectly supporting predatory lending and lobbying Congress not to pass legislation against predatory lending. These, friends, are rubber meets the road issues of our discipleship. So, make sure your money is screened. Make sure you're knowing where your money goes and getting involved. But you know what? And there are lots of resources if you want to find out about this stuff. The best resource I know is United for a Fair Economy, which is their website. You might jot it down, www.faireconomy.org. They've got tax pledges that wealthy people can take when they get their tax break. How can you pledge some of that money back to the social justice movement rather than take the money and run? And be a Republican in deed, if not word? Right? Instead, take a tax pledge. Business Owners for Responsible Estate Tax. This is a great group. They published this wonderful book called Economic Apartheid in America. It's the kind of stuff that we can use in study groups. But the best step of all, friends, and this is what I would really urge you to take seriously, whether you're investing $1 or $1 million, is community investing. Now, community investing is the most direct way you can make your surplus capital available to poor folks. These are community development financial institutions who are specifically in business to make money available to low-income communities through micro-lending, through fair housing projects, through child care programs. This is the website I want you to take down, www.communityinvest.org. It's sort of a one-stop shopping center for community investing. Let's look at a definition of community investment. Somebody want to read the first paragraph out loud for our radio audience at home?
Community investing is capital from investors that is directed to communities underserved by traditional financial services. It provides access to credit, equity, capital, and basic banking products that these communities would otherwise not have. In the U.S. and around the world, community investing makes it possible for local organizations to provide financial services to low-income individuals and to supply capital for small businesses and vital community services such as child care, affordable housing, and health care.
Let me also read the next paragraph.
Community investment institutions can give priority to people who have been denied access to capital and provide them with opportunities to borrow, save, and invest in their own communities. In addition to supplying badly needed capital in underserved neighborhoods, they provide important services such as education, mentoring, and technical support. They also build relationships between families, nonprofits, small businesses, and conventional financial institutions and markets.
Sound good? Sound like something we might want to be involved in? Okay, it's not the Kingdom of God, but it's not the Bank of America either. Friends, these are very concrete strategies. Here's the bad news. Remember, 1 out of every 8 investment dollars is in SRI, although not in this room.
bad news is that only 1% of those SRI funds are in community investing. Why? Because everybody's scared to not get their maximum return. Because we seem to think that we are divinely entitled to a maximum return that comes out of a black box. I believe people of faith can do better. I believe we could even tithe 10% of our investments to community banking. Both our household and our nonprofit organization has 100% of our money in community banking. Self-Help Credit Union is an example of this. They're based in North Carolina. We're in relationship with a number of African-American churches there. Self-Help is a wonderful credit union that does lending to low-income people. They give near-market return on their CDs. Their financial products are getting better and better every year, and the more money we put toward that, the better they're going to be. So Self-Help is a wonderful institution. I'm going to give you just three examples. The second example is a venture capital firm that's starting up in the Northwest called Upstream 21. It's a faith-based firm, and they're specifically capitalizing businesses that are green, have fair labor practices, and that are integrated into the local economy, exactly the kind of businesses we want to promote. They're a place where you can put some of your money to invest if you're interested in venture capital. And finally, if you're interested in international work, Ortho Credit, which is an ecumenical agency, is doing micro-lending all around the world. You could pick up the phone tomorrow and open up some CDs and Oiko Credit and feel real good about what your surplus capital is doing in Mozambique or in Ecuador or in Thailand. The principal friends of community investing is to use capital to build social relations rather than the other way around. Making social relations invisible in the black box in order to maximize capital. So I invite you, in the wake of this conversation, to do a little examining of your own relationships, your own investing. To do a little experimenting with a small group, or Just Faith group, or some subset of this group. The great thing about talking about this is it deprivatizes all of our considerable anxiety around these questions, and it communitizes the imagination. We can come up with good ideas. And then go ahead and seek help from people who are committed to this. There are all kinds of folks who can help you, professional advisors, funds that will help you do SRI and do community investing. There is no good reason not to do this. We also are involved in building a network called the Southeast Economic Collaborative that is trying to build capacity, build a network of financial advisors with faith-based investors so that we can make a movement. And I believe if we take our money seriously, we can actually challenge some of the banks and some of the corporations around how money is moved. Savage Economics Collaborative, you'll find on the web at savageeconomics.org. I've been very uncomfortably specific. I hope you will see that this is an attempt to put feet on big concept issues. There are lots of other things we can do, but this is a pretty fundamental one. And I wanted to make sure that you had an exposure to that so that you can go away and think about it. If you're interested in pursuing it, there's a sign-up sheet back there. You email us and we'll send you a little bit of information and a couple of people you might want to call if you're looking for an advisor. And we're not going to sell you anything. We're just going to hook you up with people who can help you if you want to investigate this more. Whatever we do, friends, when we spend this much time studying scripture, we better figure out what the payoff is, don't you think? Because otherwise it becomes another expression of our privilege, the privilege to entertain ourselves with the teaching of Jesus and not change our lives. I don't think that does any disrespect to Michael Crosby to take the next step in extrapolating beyond the whole thesis of his chapter. I think this is one of the dimensions of nonviolent discipleship for us in our context. We're out of time. I will hang around if some of you want to chat more about this, but I want to just let you know that here are some options. Thanks very much for your patient attentiveness, and see you next time around. Thanks for being a good word about you.
thank you, Ted, for coming. I think you're the emerald of our spirituality attitudes study in that you definitely have kicked it up a notch and given us something to really think about. It really is important. So I want to thank you for the work that you do and for coming to be with us. We're running a little over time, so I think we're just going to close maybe with a prayer. So let's just take a minute and thank God for the great blessings from Word and Life that we can come here and discuss these very important things. And we ask God to give us the courage to put into action the things that we learn here. And blessings on our continued work and worship. In Jesus' name. Amen.